the movie business went a little bonkers about Alaska in the 1920s. Yes, it has all happened before. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Alaskans learn about the Gold Rush, the Serum Run, World War II, but there's stuff happened in between there. Our number toll-free, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@aprn.org. The Gold Rush town of Kandel, Alaska, produced a movie star in 1922. More coming on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Wells Fargo, committed to supporting communities and Alaska residents beyond just their banking needs. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Okay. Get ready to relax and enjoy an interesting conversation about some interesting history. Leo Morgan has been in Alaska since the 1960s and has written numerous books and kind of likes the Alaska history type of book. And her latest one is entitled Eskimo Star, From the Tundra to Tinseltown, the Ray Mala Story. There's a hold this up, and that way the people that are watching on 360 North can see what it looks like. And Leo, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thanks for the invitation.
Now, you may know Lael already. In fact, I'm sure it'd be astonishing if there weren't people that already knew you listening to this show. And you may not recognize the voice because she's struggling with a little bit of respiratory here. But she came anyway because she's a trooper, as we all know. So how long? You said this is a long gestation period to get to this book.
Right. I think I started about 30 years ago. I started because someone hired me to write a chapter of a book on Ray Wise Mala. They were doing Alaskan Heroes. And I did the chapter. The book was never published. I didn't have enough to expand it to a book. And I sort of put it in a box and let it sit for about 30 years.
And then they invented the internet.
And by that time, Ray Wise Mala's grandson was aboard and living in Hollywood. And he wanted to know more about his grandfather. And I was away from all my records. And he would start calling me about once a week, once a month.
Once a week.
And it was always polite, but he just wondered. And he was buying memorabilia from his grandfather's film career. And so if he found something wonderful, he'd share it with me.
Wow.
And about 3 years later, I went back and took a look at my old records and took a look at new records that had come aboard, been discovered, and discovered there was enough to do a book. So that's when I really got to work.
I don't ever picture you making money off of this. Somehow you must already have so many hours in. I mean, would you get to the point where you talk to genealogists and track down people to interview with your detective training? I can't imagine that you're getting more than pennies on the hour, no matter what happens.
No, that wasn't what this book was all about. It just bugged me that I couldn't learn more about a subject that had been this famous, you know?
Yeah.
And it became a war game.
Well, I want to say that much as we're talking about a boy from an Inupiaq boy, Jewish in Inupiaq, I guess you would say.
Right.
A boy from Kandel, Alaska, in the Gold Rush country, north of Nome, on the way up towards, let's say, Shishmaref. A Kotzebue boy just won the Iditarod. Johnny Baker just won the race.
Sometimes those Kotzebue boys do it.
New record time. So, great. And it gives me great pleasure to announce it. So the time that you immerse us in this book, Eskimo Star, about Ray Wise Mala, who was a friend of Johnny Weissmuller.
A very close friend, yes.
And even looked, they sort of shared the body type.
They were built exactly the same height, almost the same age, had about the same kind of father.
Yeah, and there it is, isn't it? So here we have this kid that's kind of raised piecemeal in Kandel, and ends up, because of the all whatever, I mean, I guess you go back to the flu epidemic and the gold rush people coming and going, and his father is long gone, and he's basically ends up being raised by grandma.
Right. He didn't have much of a chance. His mother had been very young when she met his father and had gotten pregnant and didn't know she was pregnant when his father went off to the next gold rush. Didn't know where he was going, just off. He'd been a very well-heeled trader in Candle, and she couldn't find him, so she had the baby, and her mother's family actually raised him pretty traditionally. And then she remarried a white man who owned the biggest bar in Candle, and so he had the benefit of both worlds. She was determined he was going to have a good education, but her grandmother was determined he was going to have a good Eskimo education, so he got both.
And he seems to have had, from all we can reconstruct, I hesitate to use the word Eskimo because it's lately become sort of not politically correct, but he had, I guess you would say, an Eskimo nature, in the sense of, I've sat with people staring out at the ice for hours, and white people are not well disposed towards that sort of thing.
He had amazing patience, and he also had, not just with things or staring at the ice, but with people who abused him. He seemed to understand right off the bat that it was the times and not himself. He was also affable, really a charmer. Everybody who ever dealt with him at length said he was just charming.
So we have Ray Wise Mala, and the story itself, I mean, we could use up the whole hour telling the story of his movie career. There's no doubt about it. But essentially, I'll try and synopsize a little bit to get to the point where he becomes a star. And you get this kid who, at 15, is all of a sudden on his own, out in the world on his own, and ends up learning all sorts of things. He already knows the bar business. He kind of knows cooking. He gets crewing on the mail boat. All these things that he is learning to do as a kid. And, already experiencing discrimination, but at least he's in Alaska. And one of the things he starts learning is to run a camera for film crews, because film crews are interested in Alaska already. And we're talking like, 1918, 19.
There were tons of them up here. It's amazing. 10, 15, when the president came up to visit Harding, and they all stayed on to make their Nanooks of the North. And he was started as a boat crewman. They'd hire him because they had to have a boat to shoot walruses and so on. And then they discover, coming from California mostly, that they couldn't hand crank a camera at 40 below. And this kid could do it. The other thing I didn't know, he became an assistant cameraman in Hollywood. Well, the assistant cameraman doesn't get to look through the viewfinder to focus. It's his job to focus, and he has to guess. Like, I'm 5 feet from you, and focus accordingly. And Mala could do it better than anybody because he was a hunter.
Wow. Yeah, I think they still do that. I think you still have focus pullers, even today. Huh. And he could crank the camera because his hand didn't freeze up quick as other people. And he probably had that, endurance or whatever it is. I don't know, just seal oil stuff.
Yeah, he had been winning a lot of the Eskimo games. His grandmother had trained him to do high kicks and long distance running and so on. So he was super fit. He was also very large, very strong.
Now you look at the picture of this guy, and he is strikingly handsome. I think there's little doubt of that. I mean, he catches your eye right away. The camera loves him.
Yes.
So isn't it weird how he finally got in front of the camera, in the sense that basically this guy Van Dyke comes up here and he's going to make the colossal northern epic, but he won't hire this kid that he's got actually work for him because he's only part Eskimo.
Right. Mala had done a lot of camera work with the explorers that came up, and one particular one named Kleinschmidt, who actually made Alaska's first travelogue and then tried to do his own Nanuk of the North. And he...
I guess we better say what was important about Nanuk of the North, because it was enormously... Yeah. I mean, it was just like a landmark in the cinema industry, but because it was so long ago and during the silent movie era, it's kind of like Birth of a Nation. You hear about it, you don't really often see it.
Right. It was a movie done in Greenland, the first movie on Eskimo, and it became an international sensation. It's said to be the first documentary. Wasn't actually a documentary. It's pretty darn staged. But after that, the whole world took off and got really interested in Eskimos. And so everybody wanted to make a movie like that. And Kleinschmidt made one and had hired Mahler as his cameraman. But he also needed a leading man, so Mahler got that job. And the seniors in Nome tell me that at one point the leading lady didn't want to go out and jump from iceberg to iceberg off the beach in Nome. And so they
imagine that.
Yes. And they put Mahler in a woman's parka, and he got to play the lead lady too for a while. So he'd had his acting experience. But when he got to Hollywood, he was a cameraman, and nobody much even thought of him as being in front of the camera. I think that's because most cameramen never were.
Yeah. And yet, as it turns out, while this movie's being shot up in Alaska, and he's still, I guess, down in Hollywood, word comes to him that the star has bolted.
Well, he actually had made his own Hollywood movie. He and an independent producer, he was working for Fox Studio. Looked like Fox would go under. So they pooled their money and went to Barrow and made a movie we've just gotten our hands on called Igloo. And it's a full Hollywood movie, and he starred in that. It was one of the first independent productions in Hollywood. Then he came back, became a cameraman again, and when Van Dyke made this movie, which had been written by Peter Freuchen, a very famous author at the time, Mahler thought he'd get a starring role in it because he was perfect. They wanted somebody who spoke Inupiat. But Van Dyke wouldn't hire him because he was part Jewish.
In the film industry, imagine that. That's unheard of. So this ends up being a huge epic. However, it really didn't quite ever justify its promotion. I mean, I guess it did better financially than the Legends of the Time say. Eskimo was the title, the ultimate title.
It started Eskimo did very well financially. It made its recovery in Europe, where it was incredibly, they publicized it differently in Europe. And it really did make a good amount of money.
Oh, and they had some sex scenes in there and changed the title to...
Yeah, they did.
Something salacious.
Yes, they did. And Peter Freuchen went over to promote it. And
he's pretty relentless at that. Yeah. From everything I can understand from the way you describe it in this book, this guy...
He could sell ice boxes to Eskimos, yes.
So now he's a genuine star.
Yes, and if you look at the European magazines of that time, he's on cover after cover. They just love him.
Wow.
Why
do you suppose we lost track of all this? I mean, the only time I ever heard of Ray Mahler was I think I saw a picture in a book at one point, soon after I moved to Alaska. And then I got to know Ted Mahler. And Ted said, well, of course, I'm the son of, who? Well, he was a pretty famous movie. Oh, really? And I thought, Ted's kind of making this up. Au contraire. This guy was big stuff. He was hanging out on the yachts with Errol Flynn and Johnny Weissmuller and the rest of them.
He sure was. He knew everybody in the trade, and he knew him for years, and more than most people, because when he wasn't working as a movie star, he was working as a cameraman. He went back. After he did well and got wonderful reviews in Eskimo, But Van Dyke said that he had no career in movies because he was an exotic. People would just expect him to play Eskimo roles, and there weren't going to be that many.
So it was typecasting, but it actually was beyond that because there was a little ghettoization. I mean, the Motion Picture Association itself had a code, apparently. There were not to be any interracial relationship. I mean, this is a little hard to picture nowadays.
Yeah, you couldn't have a white person in a romantic lead against a non-white person, which cut him out of being our leading man.
And he put up with all this. He
took didn't this have as, too much choice.
No, he didn't have any choice at all. But, I mean, there's no sign of the resentment that you see in Stars later about this sort of thing out of Ray Mala.
It was a very different era, but you'll see that, of course, there are all these idiotic stereotypes today about Eskimos swapping their wives and all this. And he never missed a chance in any interview I ever saw to correct the facts if somebody asked him or if somebody presented wrong facts against Alaskan people, to correct them very gently. It wasn't the age where you ran out and went around protesting, because if you protest, somebody knock your nose off. But he was always very consistent in trying to educate the public about the fact that what was going on up here made as much sense as what was going on in Depression-era Hollywood.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, it also rams together so in such a really short period of time. When his career is going fairly well, the Depression hits.
Right, and he's not hurt by it. Actually, he's helped by it because movies became really big. What happened was he got a portfolio. He hired two of the best photographers in Hollywood, portrait, and put on all these different garbs, as a sheik, him as a matador. He really was an exotic. He could look many different ways. He got a couple of leading parts after that, one as a government agent in a secret island, and then he got a film playing opposite Lotus Long, another exotic, in Last of the Pagans.
So you could the exotics could have a relationship with other exotics.
Yes, they could.
Hmm.
But then he got to that age where a lot of male actors do, where you're not leading man anymore. And he took small parts, supporting parts, and then he went back to being a cameraman. He was a wonderful cameraman. He was working with some very famous people. He actually was assistant cameraman on Laura, which won an Oscar.
That was a great film.
He was so good they kept his team together quite a bit. He worked with Otto Preminger, loved him. He was very, very good. He was a pioneer in the filming as well as in front of the camera. By the time he got to be about 40s, television was coming in, and he was getting, it looked like his stage career, his film career, was going back on track. He was getting more offers. And in fact, just before he died at age 52, he had done a full-length movie called Red Snow, and had Cecil B. DeMille apparently had offered him another part.
Uh-huh. So we get, go ahead, clear it up there.
Yeah, off. So he had a whole new career coming up.
Yeah, and there's this Alfred Hitchcock incident. I'm trying to place the history of Hitchcock, and I don't know actually this film that Ray Mala was a cameraman for, but I know how picky Hitchcock was from the very beginning, and this is already, he's got Joseph Cotten, and you know, he's got a really good cast and so forth going.
Mala was meticulous and very, very careful with his work. I interviewed a number of people who hired him who said he was just a real professional cameraman. And think about it. He came in as sound was invented, Technicolor. He was in on all those experiments. You know, when sound came in, the cameras were making a lot of noise. They had to put bonnets over the cameras. all those experiments, he worked with those guys. He was right there on the ground floor, and he loved being a cameraman.
It looks like there's more to be written.
Well, he was a very private man. I think there's about 5 letters, and they're mostly business letters. And that's why I didn't really want to do the book in the first place, because unlike other people that I've known and written about, like Howard Roark, I at least knew Howard enough to get into his head. And Mahler died in 1952, so I never met him. And he was a very, very private person, although he had a lot of lovely leading ladies, and he certainly had a lot of lady friends. He kept his film career and his personal career very, very separate. We don't know a lot about that.
Well, maybe it has to go to the realm of fiction in order to get to broader context. But, you know, I'm thinking this way. By the way, we're speaking with Lael Morgan. She's the author of Eskimo Star, From the Tundra to Tinseltown, The Ray Mahler Story. And it is Talk of Alaska. And our phone number is 1-800-478-8255. And we're open for your calls. I want to get into this business of the effort to, the Ray Mahler Film Festival will be coming up, and the effort to identify some of the people in all these pictures that we know that there are people in Alaska who are going to know who these people are in these pictures as Talk of Alaska continues. But I want to turn now to the festival, because this is amazing. I mean, what I was saying about the context is that the... I didn't really realize till I was doing this show for some time and talking to various people how sometimes an Alaskan's view of Alaska history doesn't really put it into the big picture. And so when you, for instance, take the national environmental movement, you can see Alaska playing a role in the development of the various parts of the environmentalist ethic down through the years, especially when it comes to land and land conservation and all that. And it becomes very clear, and especially in Douglas Brinkley's new book, you know, springing off of his biography of Teddy Roosevelt, you can just see, well, Alaska was really, you know, without Alaska and the Alaska issues, the growth of the environmental movement, land conservation, the view of wilderness in the United States would be very different, because Bob Marshall, all these different people, were intimately connected with Alaska. And now I'm coming to realize that the same thing happens in the film industry. Maybe not to quite the same degree, but this madness, this rush to Alaska by all these film crews after Nanook of the North, but actually even taking place some before that, there was a reason why they were coming. It was because it excited something in the public imagination. And so that's why I say I think there's more to be written, especially when you start talking about the technical part of filmmaking and the advent of sound, the changes in technology. Here we have Ray Wise Mala, who, you know, was there for all those things. Maybe it needs to be fictionalized a bit, but just a big story of the history of Hollywood could be written through this guy's story.
Well, he really was up here in the very beginning. And one of the things, I wasn't into the film scene when I started this, but I ended up doing a filmology, and we know that he shot many films that are not listed, but we've got quite a list, and he was in quite a few too. Then to try and find some of these films he shot, and I started looking 30 years ago. I found the first film, the only remaining film, Kleinschmidt did of Alaska. And he's, remember, the guy that he and Ray did the first travelogue, and that's gone. But the second one I found at the British Film Institute. Nobody had taken it out of mothballs in 30 years when I saw it. It took me about 2 years to get them to give us a copy. Then the film that
he
made...
Well, you know, I mean, with that old celluloid, you're running a risk when you run it through the... through the sprockets.
Yeah.
I mean, you're gonna
start
blow hurting.
Up. Yeah, it's made of gunpowder, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then the way he got to Hollywood is fascinating. He was in Nome during the diphtheria epidemic, and he was had shot a lot of footage by that time. When Gunter came in with the serum, he got Gunter to do a reenactment. He borrowed a camera from a friend, and he shot the footage. And he sold it to Pathé News. He'd worked for Pathé previously. And then his backer at Pathé got him a job at Fox Studio in Hollywood. Where's the film? Well, when Salisbury did The Cruelest Miles, I found out where the film was. She mentioned seeing it. So I called her, and it was UCLA. She had no idea who shot it, but I knew there was only one person who could have shot it.
Wow.
So we got that footage. And then the independent movie that he made in Barrow, spent months up there, Barrow and Point Hope. Universal ended up owning that, and they have given us that as long as we show it for free. It is an amazing footage, how they ever did it in those days. Just one cameraman, a skin boat, and it's magnificent. Walrus, some weather shots in there like you'll never see out there on the moving ice of the Chukchi Sea. Amazing stuff.
Wow. And then you tell the tale of Van Dyke trying to do this movie, Eskimo, and having trouble with the Russians. In fact, everybody had trouble with the Russians because they had a revolution over there.
Yeah, and they didn't like our guys because we'd been running over there and not paying any tariffs.
Uh-huh.
So they weren't going to look very friendly on American movie crews out shooting whales on the Siberian side, you know.
And even in those days, it was incredibly bureaucratic to get any kind of permit to do anything over on that side.
Chances are they just said no, like they did to Rasmussen.
Yeah. And so we got people that came up here who wanted to do a project and couldn't because they got stuck in the ice.
Knud Rasmussen goes all the way across North America, wants to go to Siberia, and the Russians won't let him in. On the other hand, Ray Mala and Kleinschmidt were over there all the time.
Yeah.
And that's why some of this footage is really valuable. Also, Ray did that independent production in 1930-something, early 1930, I think. And Kleinschmidt and he was shooting in 1924, 1925. The artifacts, the furs you see the Eskimos wearing in those movies are truly amazing. And so when I found all this rare footage that nobody here had ever seen, I thought, let's do a film festival. Let's get this stuff around the state. And then it dawned on me, having seen Eskimo a few times, that there are never any credits for the Eskimo players who were so good in their real names. It just says Eskimo cast. They don't even give Ray Wise-Mala credit. They call him Churik or something, but they don't use his real name. And I found a guy named Bob Huntsman, who in 1978 was up in Tin City Bob, some of you know, and he was seeing Eskimo, and he discovered, they were shown, I think, in the Doolin site, he discovered just about everybody in the audience had been in the movie. So he took down their names and he interviewed them. And so I asked Bob if he would expand his list. And now, as we're showing these films around, of course, it's many, many years later, but sometimes people recognize their grandfathers. So Bob's just added 8 names to the list. And we're going to have real Eskimo credits for every Eskimo name we can find that are in those movies.
Wow. So this has been building for a while to have this Ray Mala Film Festival, Ray Wise-Mala Film Festival. We got to take a little break here, Leo Morgan, but we'll be right back as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Thin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at thinair.com.
Indian Trust Land IIM account Indian Trust account $3.4 billion settlement. Settlement biu nakhochivne khanacht tarvikun website amun indiantrust.com amun biu mauten khol toklorlugu 1-800-961-6109.
I had not been in Alaska too long when this guy came up to me and he said, "Hey, I've just been over to the Russian Far East. My name is Ted Mala." And I said, "Oh, yeah?" He says, "Yeah, I'm a doctor, and you may not have heard of me, but my father was a famous movie star." Oh, right. But he had been over to the Russian Far East, and he was a doctor, and his dad had been a movie star, a really famous one in the 1920s and going all the way up into the 1940s, Ray Mala, Eskimo Star. We're talking with Leo Morgan, author of Eskimo Star, and she's telling us that often the Eskimo people in the movies that were made up here got no credit whatsoever, including Ray Mala. And in fact, in Eskimo, he plays a character named Mala, because he's Ray Wise up to that point, and he takes that name for himself because of his rocky financial relationship with his dad.
Yeah, he finally caught up with his dad, and his dad was a winning rascal. He was a real...
winning rascal, been through millions, though.
Yeah, he'd been through millions. And of course, Ray was glad to find his father, and they had a nice relationship, but Ray went off to Tahiti for a year to make this movie. When he came back, he discovered his father had infiltrated his bank account and spent all his money.
Whole bunch of it went into some real estate scam in Pismo Beach.
Right, and Pismo didn't Pismo. And so rather than queer relationships with his father, he simply adopted the last name of Mala, which people called him anyway after Eskimo, and made it his legal name, and then the old guy couldn't go and burgle his bank account anymore.
And they remained friends. And this is what interests me so much about the character of Ray Mala, that he was that kind of person. It seemed that he was very likable, and he may have been firm, but you don't get a picture of anybody at all obsequious or anything like that, but he was a person that had a whole lot of equanimity.
One reason I didn't want to write about him was he was just too nice.
Yeah.
Howard Roark was at least a rotter as a young man, you know?
Yeah.
And that was kind of interesting. But Ray was a genuinely nice guy. But it's puzzling. He could wait. And he eventually got darn near everything he wanted. But he did it a very quiet, patient way.
Yeah. Well, did he ever really, I guess he saved some money up and then his dad went and spent that money. Did he accumulate that much of a fortune? I mean, he was not like in a rank with Weissmuller and Errol Flynn and all these. I mean, he might have hung out with him. He did hang out with him. But like when it came to their poker games and so forth, you know, did he really have that kind of pocket money to?
No, because I know the family was stressed when he died suddenly of a heart attack. I suspect he might not even had decent insurance, and so no, he didn't pile up the. They lived modestly, they lived well, but they weren't like Hollywood rich.
So how did Ted, who I met and who I know, and who's a friend, and born I guess in 1946, how did he come into being? His mother was Russian, right?
Right. She was absolutely beautiful. She was a stand-in for a famous Hollywood star. And she was living in a very respectable boarding house for young ladies who wanted to come to Hollywood. And Ray met her at one of the open houses there and just fell in love with her. And she'd been pretty much under her mother's thumb. She was a Russian princess. They had escaped during the revolution. She and her mother were very close. And when she started going with Ray, her mother was not happy. She'd been going with Navarro, the famous movie star. And
you get the feeling she kind of liked these romantic types.
I think she liked exotics, yeah.
Yeah.
And nobody thought she'd ever buck her mother to run off with Ray. Furthermore, he couldn't marry her legally in California because there was a law against white people marrying.
Miscegenation, they called it.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm not even going to try to pronounce it.
I know. I remember that when I was a kid. I was reading that. What is that?
Yeah, it must be bad.
Yeah.
Such a long word.
Dirty, at least.
Yeah. So, but she fell head over heels in love with him. And she was barely 5 feet tall. Just like a little princess, she was gorgeous. And, of course, here he is, way over 6 feet. They must have been quite a team. But she went off to Mexico and married him. And it was a real love match. I don't think either of them looked one inch beyond that for all their marriage. But when he died of a heart attack in 59, they were so close. She didn't survive him by much more than 6 months, I don't think.
Wow.
And Ted was only 6 years old. He had a grandmother, his mother's mother, who just took over his life, wouldn't let his father's father see him, wouldn't let anybody near him, wouldn't let anybody adopt him. Hollywood took up a big collection to help fund the child because there wasn't that much money, and that nobody knows what happens to. Shouldn't end up in Ted's pocket.
No, I don't think so.
No. And the grandmother shipped him off to military school. And once in a while, former neighbors and relatives would sneak in and get him out for a while. But he just had, you know, after being the center of this really happy family, and I've interviewed people who stayed with the Mahlers, they kept open house in Hollywood. They say it was just a wonderful, warm, happy family. It must have been a terribly hard way to grow up.
So do you have a continuing relationship with Ted Jr.?
Yes, both Ted Jr. and his son. I mean, Ted Jr. and his father.
Yeah. Because Ted Mahler really is Ray Ted Mahler, right?
Well, it gets a little confusing because they both call themselves Ted Mahler.
Yeah.
There's Ted Mahler, the doctor.
Yeah.
And then there's Ted Mahler, who used to live in Hollywood, who's now working for Nana Corporation. And, they have been really good on this book. They wanted to see it. Ted Sr., for years, would say after I didn't do the chapter, when are you going to do that book? And I would snarl, never. And then his son actually got me into it. But they haven't meddled in the book. They haven't tried to put in their spin, which I'm very appreciative of, because that's not the way I work.
Right. So I'm still trying to figure out, Lael Morgan, how this film festival comes together. I can tell your role in it, but, I mean, you don't have the resources to bankroll something like this.
We didn't bankroll it. It's sort of a do-it-yourself film festival. I tried to find a statewide sponsor, and I couldn't. So I simply started writing to people in Kotzebue, Barrow, Point Hope, Nome, and said, hey, I've got all these films. I'm going to try to get them so you don't have to pay to show them. And would you like to be a part of this? And so, and thank goodness, just about when I was hanging by a thread, Nana came and donated $5,000 to get some of those films that were on 35mm celluloid transferred to DVDs and to pay for the shipping, and also to get Ted Jr. to go to the villages and introduce them. So that's been a great help.
Wow. So you don't have to be the MC so much.
No.
That's
and
great.
In fact, I won't be going. Those films will be mailed out, or Ted will carry them. And we're doing Bethel. We've done one in Juneau, one in Fairbanks. We did the Native Arts. We were trying to get the movies identified, the players. and Nome, of course, Anchorage on the 30th and 31st.
Yeah, coming right up. Then that's Beartooth, right?
Yes, Beartooth. We're doing a book signing on the 29th at the Anchorage Museum, which will be kind of fun because we're showing one of my favorite Mala movie.
What's is Igloo or which
no.
one? No.
It's a silly, it was a 14-part serial.
What is one of these Republic jobs?
Yeah, Robinson Crusoe of Clipper Island. It's got all these spies and Mala's wearing an ice cream suit. His co-star is a horse and a beautiful lady. It's and a big Saint Bernard, and so we're showing that at the museum, along with book signing, and so that's going to be a lot of fun.
And the Beartooth, they get what, Igloo and Eskimo? What do they get?
They're starting with the first night. They're going to show Igloo for free, and that's the Arctic Slope Native Corporation has funded that.
And I'll refresh my memory. Was Igloo actually was shot in Barrow or partly?
Igloo was shot in Barrow almost totally, except that the missionary wouldn't let him shoot whales.
Yeah.
So they went to Point Hope. So there's Point Hope people in it too. And Universal has given us that one for free to show, but if you charge for it, they would charge you. So the bear...
And you have to make it on popcorn and pizza.
Right, and the Beartooth needs to keep the lights on.
Right.
So they got the donation from Arctic Slope. That's the first one up on the 30th. And then it's going to be followed by People in Peril, which is the Tahitian mm-hmm. one. And then Red Snow, which is the last film he made. And then the next night, they're going to do two showings of Eskimo. And then a very interesting thing, we're going to do a special showing for MIPA, the Alaska Moving Image Preservation People, a benefit on the first April Fool's Day over at the Consortium Library. And we're using snippets of all the films we've discovered. Ted Jr. and I will be emceeing, explaining where we found the films. But what's nice is we're showing them in chronological order, so you get to see how Mala's career develops, how he ages, how the film industry goes. It should be a pretty interesting night.
Well, you know, I haven't entirely finished the book. It just came out.
It didn't. Or, it's not officially
it's
out
actually
yet.
Not out.
You've got a bootleg copy, sir.
But from all the pictures and everything, unless nobody took any pictures later in his life, I mean, he stays in shape his whole life.
That's so incredible. You know, the movie they made in the 30s, the independent production, Igloo, his partner in that was Ewing Scott, a famous Hollywood producer. And Ewing's career fell on hard times about the same time Mala's did. But in early 1950s, he got a job shooting footage for Red Snow. And he incorporated in Barrow, same places that they'd shot Igloo. He incorporated, and when you see Red Snow, you'll see pictures of Ray Mala taken in the 30s. And he's aged so little that you can see, you can't tell a difference.
This is just amazing.
Yeah.
We're talking about the Ray Mala story with Leo Morgan, who has researched and put out this book on Epicenter Press. And we got the film festival, basically has already started and continuing in various locations in Alaska, including Anchorage. And Maya joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Maya, with Leo Morgan.
Yes, hi, Leo. Thank you for all of the great work and really interesting research. Can't wait to get your book. And I was just curious, are you following in the book the work that, I believe her name is Glenda? Sorry, Galena List, the daughter of Ted Mala, has been doing as a SAG actress. She's in Los Angeles.
Right. She just came back from Texas. She's doing a lot of corporate productions right now. And she was up last weekend. She'll be up for the festival, too, in Anchorage, and for the book signing.
And she's named after her grandmother, then?
Yes, she's named after her grandmother.
Cool. Anything else, Maya?
No, I was just curious to see, you know, the influence that his career has had directly on his family as well as other generations, and, you know, encourage more Alaska Natives to move into the film industry and theatrics in general. It would be great.
Yes, and I think we're going to revisit that area, I think, in future shows, because I don't want to lose track of the notion that we might have a growing industry here now, and maybe we need to have more training for film crew people in the state of Alaska, and this role model could really serve as a real example here. I mean, this guy was obviously the real stuff.
Well, the Mahler Film Festival we put on in conjunction with the 40th anniversary of the Alaska Land Claims Settlement Act, and one of the things that we thought would be good would be to honor our current work, the work of our film office here, and to bring to light the fact this has always been a great place to make a movie.
Always, that's right. Well, and we'll have a film major starting in a couple of years here up at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, so that'll be another great opportunity.
All right, Maya, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
And that reminder, because that is an area I don't want to lose track of. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, Wells Fargo, providing financial tools and resources for purchasing a home or planning for the future, Wells Fargo Bank, N.A., and by ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program.
Well, I'm picking up the book to show an image to the viewers on 360 North, and it's two very physically beautiful people. The caption is, "New favorite wife. Having lost one wife to the evil traitor, Mala makes Lotus Long the object of his affections, a trust that is not misplaced." The family, this one came through the family, but it's clearly a movie publicity shot. And so we've got two exotics here, two Hollywood exotics.
Mamu Clark is probably the most amazing. He starred with her in Robinson Crusoe of Clipper Island. She had starred with Clark Gable in Mutiny on the Bounty. She was a Hawaiian and a Hawaiian princess. And it's interesting, she was at UCLA when she got her bounty role, and but she had exactly the same problems Ray did. She was an exotic. She'd gotten great reviews in Mutiny on the Bounty, but there were no more parts for her. Eventually, she quits Hollywood. She doesn't have a job like cameraman, and she goes back to school, takes a film major at USC, and graduates and writes a book and stays in the industry just on the sidelines.
Hmm. Exotic, I think we probably should review for our audience, is code for of some race other than white. And you weren't allowed. There were the motion picture industry agreed not to show mixed couples in movies for how many years? This went on into the 50s.
Yes, it did.
Yeah, I grew up with this. Didn't even know it was there.
Well, the other, it's nice to run other exotics' film careers along beside Mahler, because one thing that saved him was the fact that he had real talent for another job in Hollywood. But Anna May Wong, probably the most beautiful and talented of all the stars, her sister Lulu Wong was in Eskimo, and her sister decided, "No thanks, I don't want to do Hollywood." Anna May, because she couldn't, she upstaged Marlene Dietrich in her first movie, and she was really good.
That took some doing.
Yeah, she was really good. She also could sing and dance. She made a career. She was multilingual. She made a great career in Europe, but she eventually pretty much drank herself to death, I think.
So it makes me think of what a big deal it must have been when Orson Welles takes up with Eartha Kitt.
It was a big deal, yeah.
I mean, they were busting a paradigm, a big fat one there.
Yeah.
Huh.
But when you look at what happens to Anna May Wong and Mamel Clark and a lot of the other ones that, because when, ironically, they wouldn't cast Mahler in the beginning in Eskimo because he was part Jewish. And yet all the female leads were Japanese and Chinese because we all knew that Eskimo women couldn't act, you know, which was a polite way of staying. Maybe their standard of beauty wasn't accepted by the American public.
Well, I don't know. Hopefully this time around, but I don't know. The signs aren't good. You'd like to think that the industry would have grown up a little bit this time around when it comes to Alaska. You'd like to think that.
Well, it's tough to make films up here. I mean, just physically. And I think I didn't quite realize how tough until I saw those early 1925, 1930 films. When you realize I'm educated enough now so I know what they didn't have to work with. And it's just what they used was human stamina to make up the difference from the gadgets and the electronics. It's amazing.
Man, the lighting challenges, I don't even start on that. Let's go to Francine, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Francine.
Hello, Steve. Hello, Leo. Listen, I just wanted to say a little something about the showing of Eskimo and Juno. My family, my daughter and son-in-law, and my two grandchildren, 7 and 9 years old, went. What I want to encourage people to do is to think of their families, think of their children. My feeling about particularly Eskimo, but I'm also looking forward to all of the other films that I haven't seen, so I'm going to be there, should be seen by everybody that lives in Alaska, and particularly children, because the Eskimo film shows subsistence lifestyles. It shows the real environment of Alaska at that time. The story is a very, it's one that's as true today in some ways as it was then. It has a lot of integrity. It is an exotic film. It is filmed in the 1920s and 30s, so it's different than what we're doing in Hollywood today. My two children were absolutely fascinated, and who they really loved was Ted Mala, who was the grandson of Ray Mala, and they looked at him and he said, he looks just like his grandfather. They were totally starstruck. So bring your children.
All right.
For families, particularly Eskimo, okay?
Well, I mean, yeah, Leah was talking about the artifacts. I mean, the parkas alone.
Absolutely. You know, I've always said that we should have a whole curriculum, I mean, at least in at the college level. And I think every teacher should see this. Because you learn so much about what the culture was, and you see things that you'll never see, you know, in real life today. So the wonderful, wonderful things.
And the good news is that Warner Brothers actually transferred that scratchy old 35mm to DVD, and the new version is beautiful.
Really?
Oh, I love it.
They did some restoration.
Yes, they did.
Oh.
And I've seen Eskimo over and over, and every time I see it, I think, oh, well, I've already seen it. And then I just get totally sucked into it.
Wow. There was a degree of mastery in those old screwballs in the 20s.
It's amazing. And yeah. And again, you know, you're going to have to read Lael's book to look at the backstory in terms of, you know, I think they didn't even hear about the camera crew for months. I mean, as far as Hollywood knew, they died.
Right. Oh, well, actually, rumor said they had.
More of the facts than I do. But I mean, I'm going to read her book because I want to know all of that. And to me, it's just fascinating they actually accomplished it.
All right. Thanks, Francine, for your call. Let's go now to Fairbanks. Fairbanks, Don joins the program. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Leo Morgan, Don.
Hi. Yeah, I hadn't heard the names of Sarah Elder or Lenny Kamerling mentioned at all, and they're a couple of filmmakers, particularly from the early 1970s. They did On the Spring Ice and Whaling, and Lenny's the curator of University of Alaska Museum of the North's film collection, and they would probably love to hear about this. I've been trying to email Sarah. She's teaching at the University of Buffalo, and I think Lenny's out of town because I left a message on his phone. But Lael, this really exciting what you're telling us about today, and I hope a lot of that the schools around the state, particularly in the rural areas, are listening to this, because this is really valuable information you're disseminating today.
Well, it's hard to get your hands on these films. I haven't tried for the last 2 years and been decorating with holy people like Warner Brothers, who still charge to show it. But they do know we're here now, and I think they'll make some reasonable deals, and some like Universal are letting us show things for free. So it's a good chance to kind of see what's out there.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, and I expect there'll be a bunch of waves made by the Ray Mala Film Festival. Ray Wise Mala.
Definitely. Thanks again.
All right. Bye-bye. Thank you. Lael, I'm going to close the show by throwing a few names at you, and you just toss me an anecdote if you can. All right, you ready for a volley? Oh,
okay.
A lightning round. Okay. Ray Milland.
Ray Milland. Now, I'm not so good on that one.
All right, I'll take another one. John Wayne.
John Wayne was on the show that where Mala quit and came to Alaska to do his own film. Wayne had been the prop man and on a show that Mala had filmed earlier. And then he did a little bit and he got a leading role. And here's Mala, still assistant cameraman, and he wants a leading role, too. And John Wayne's a year younger than he is.
And a little taller.
Yeah. And so that's when he decides, darn, I'm not going to stay here behind the camera. I'm going up and do this independent production in Barrow. So he really got old Mala moving.
Dorothy L'Amour.
Dorothy L'Amour was standoffish, and I think that Ray is the only one who got tour on Jungle Princess in a personal way. They were good friends.
Huh. Thank you so much for being with us on the show today.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
And thank you for all your effort on this. I think that you've put another keystone into the Alaska history saga.
Thank you.
All right. And thanks to our crew here. I got to shut up because we're going to do the credits. It's Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century, member FDIC, equal housing lender, and by ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. If you are an individual owner of Indian Trust land, an IIM account holder, or heir to an Indian Trust landowner or account holder, you may be eligible to receive money from a $3.4 billion federal settlement. To get a detailed written notice about the settlement that explains your legal rights, you may visit IndianTrust.com or call 1-800-961-6109. This message sponsored by the Native American Trust. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.